Welcome to Troweling Down, Biblical Archaeology for the 21st Century. Hi, I'm Gary Byers. This is Dr. Stephen Collins, our resident rock star. And we're not going to talk about rocks today. We're not really going to talk about pots today. We're going to talk about people's bones today.
Bones, people.
Bones.
Yes. Of course, when you have an archaeological site like Tal Hamon, which is a big city in antiquity, in fact, we now know it is the largest continuously occupied Bronze Age city in the whole southern Levant that would take in all of the area of Israel and Jordan today. And so that's saying something. It's a big hub of civilization. It's a city-state. Tal Hamon is the urban core, the fortified urban core of a city-state, and around that city-state we have the core plus satellites going all around it. So you have the core in the middle, satellite towns and villages all around it, but then they utilize 100% of their landscape. So landscape archaeology is a big deal these days.
Yeah, it is.
Trying to figure out how everything works together, all the moving parts of a functioning political entity like a city-state. And so what we have found is that our ancient folks, Bronze Age folks, utilized every inch of their environment. If they weren't using it for their town itself, they were using it for farming. So they were surrounded by farmland. So all the arable farmland in the area was being planted and harvested for the sake of the city-state and all of its small towns.
So if you could grow crops on this land, that's what we used it for.
That's right.
But there were other parts.
If it were croppable, I guess.
That's good, croppable. Remember that.
Yep. So... But then, when you have a city-state that big, and we're talking about maybe, we've estimated anywhere from, say, 40 to 60,000 people crammed into 400 square kilometers. Well, that many people crammed into 400 square kilometers is not that crowded.
No.
But ancient cities, even on the upper tier, say the upper 2% of city size in ancient Canaan, the southern Levant, would range anywhere from, say, 50 acres to 200 acres in that upper echelon of size. And so the populations might range from a few thousand to maybe 10,000 at the very most.
Mm-hmm.
But in our case, and in other cases as well, but in our case, we're surrounded by guardian towns, fortified towns, and then the whole landscape is dotted with worker villages.
Yeah.
Now, if you have a main town in the middle, and you have fortified towns all around, and dozens and dozens, and maybe hundreds, we don't know, because they get sort of lost in the shuffle of modern agriculture, but all of these little towns and villages, and maybe just outlier houses that aren't really connected to a village, but all of these are the farmers themselves, the workers, and that's a lot of people working a lot of land because the rich people live in the city. The average farmer does not live inside the fortifications. They live outside, which, knowing, if you know something about ancient warfare, it might be better to be living outside because... If you're stuck in the city, you get stuck in a siege, you might get taken, you might get killed. Whereas if you're living out in a little house out amidst the agricultural fields, you can always leave to the hills with your family and hide out until the invading army is gone. So there's some advantages to not living in the cities. And of course, cities were often polluted. Just city pollution through history has always been difficult. You get a whole bunch of human beings crammed into a small space, and things can get smelly and ugly.
Yep.
Well,
speaking of smelly and ugly.
Yeah. Not only did they use a lot of their flat ground. They're arable land for agriculture, but they, with this much of a population, you have people dying constantly.
Yes.
The mortality rate, the infant mortality rate itself in antiquity was very high. If you had 10 kids, you'd be lucky to that three or four of them would live beyond toddler age. And even at that, the average, and we're talking about the time of Abraham here for the Bronze Age, the average person is living maybe around 30, 35 years old. 50 would be an old guy. And so if you lived to be older than that, you were a really, really rare person, you a very honored person if you were in your 60s or 70s.
You and I would be extremely honored.
Oh, we'd be very honored,
be
I think.
Really honored. Honorable is who we are.
Yeah. So people are dying all the time. So what do you do with all those bodies? Well, these are people, a lot of these, if they're older people, they're people of honor.
Yeah.
So you put them in every family has an ancestral tomb.
Yeah.
Okay, they have a traditional tomb in which they have been placing the bodies of their relatives for generation upon generation. And so these are generally cave tombs in our area.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be cave tombs going up the wadis, going up the ravines. There are just many, many caves into the sides of those ravine walls, wadi walls.
Into solid rock now. We're talking about carved into solid rock. Some of them would already be started naturally.
Kind of a natural cave,
But they're not in dirt. It's all carved into solid rock.
Yeah.
And they
might be carved in between two geological layers, two layers of rock. And if there's softer material in between, that's a good place to go in sideways and build a tomb. So everywhere around us, there are tombs. Almost 360, and especially to the east in the hills and to the south in the hills. But then we have also another feature, the dolmens. Now, these are standing stones. These are vertical, I guess you might call them orthostats, even though this is not particular architectural construction. These large vertical stones with a table on top. Now, the word dolmen, I think, is a Gaelic word that means table. And so these tabletops were sort of, some people have fashioned them as maybe tomb replacements. That's the way most people used to think of them. In other words, if you don't have caves, if you have dolmen material, if you have the kinds of stones, big rocks you need to make dolmens with, then you make dolmens. And so they're sort of maybe a substitution for a cave tomb. However, in our research and our excavations, and we were fortunate to excavate three undisturbed dolmens, which I think, I can't remember too many people or anybody who's ever excavated a complete dolmen because they're typically robbed out.
Mm-hmm.
You get the whole pottery there. That's why the looters in antiquity and all the way up through most of the 20th century were looting these things, selling these things off, unfortunately, in the pottery shops.
One of our tombs, or one of our dolmens, had 20 or 30 whole vessels inside.
35, I think.
35 whole vessels inside. And so, you know, you can understand why looters would want to get into there, because that's great stuff. Of course, archaeologists do it differently. It goes to the storehouse in Salt in Jordan for our site. So it's a whole different game. But that's why these tombs and dolmens get looted, because they know there's cool stuff inside, most of them.
And so, but we have discovered that the dolmen chambers are not burial chambers. They are memorial chambers for the receiving of offerings to the, seemingly offerings in honor of or to the ancestors.
Yes.
And often with a token bone or two taken into the dolmen, deposited, the chamber would be opened, these things deposited in a ritual ceremony.
So we don't find skeletons. We find a bone or two or three, but that's it. And depending on the number of burials, and I guess whose burial, maybe the old guy gets a bone put in, maybe, you know, kids don't, you know, you got to be honorific to get that something. But just bones, no skeletons.
Right. And if you're doing this on a pretty regular basis, because people had a lot of deaths in their families, of course, then this thing's going to be open and closed many times. Well, it would get full after a while. And it seems like they would just take the stuff that's been there from last year, shove it out of the way. They just push it out of the way, make room for a new offering, and eventually you can only push so far. And then you have to take it all out, and we actually found a rectangular sort of dump receptacle down the hill where stuff had just been taken out, broken, and just thrown in. Pieces of bone, pieces of pottery, and so evidently, periodically, they would clean out the dolmen and make room for the next generation or two of dead people, or bones from dead people. So we call the dolmens in our area, over 1,500 original dolmens, many destroyed, very few existing today. Even there were about 500 of them that we documented on the front end of our excavations. And now I think of those, most of those are gone now.
Yeah.
Have been destroyed either by road work or things like gravel works, or it's kind of sad. But people are dying all the time. So a lot of the landscape is being taken up by dolmens and tombs.
The landscape that is not arable land to grow crops on.
And we call that the necroscape.
Nice word. Okay.
The part of the landscape that's devoted to the burial of the dead and the honoring of the dead. And of course, there are many other aspects to that. But sometimes we find dead people in tombs. We'll either find them in tombs or pieces of them in dolmens. But sometimes we find them in the city, in a city context. Now, one of them is a child burial. And because the Middle Bronze Age is noted for its underfloor child burials, they in your house. And we don't know, by the way, if these are sacrifices or they're just simply infants who lost their lives early, very early in life. So hard to tell that sort of thing, but my gut tells me they're child sacrifices, because you're putting them there for to bless the house for a reason. There's some ritual, religious reason for doing that, and if it's just the burial of children of a dead child, then floors of houses should be pockmarked with these burials. Would have been so many.
Yeah,
but there aren't that many. Not every house has them. A few houses have one, maybe two. And there are examples of adult burials as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't often know the nature, because we can't get inside their head and we don't have any written records. So we don't know what the circumstances surrounding these burials is most of the time, or any of the time. But sometimes we find them in condition and in locations where they are not burials. They are circumstantially dead.
Circumstantially dead.
And
they ought to use that on CSI or something.
Yeah,
this guy is circumstantially dead.
Other than purposefully.
Yes.
Okay. Purposeful death would be somebody's executed or something like that.
Sacrifice.
Sacrificed. Accidentally dead would be, I think, circumstantially dead. That's a circumstance that creates a death. An earthquake. Collapsing on causing the house to collapse on someone. A violent destruction such as befell the city of Tal al-Hammam, Sodom, at the end of the Middle Bronze Age would be such a thing. Something that utterly destroys the city, brings it into ruins, and traps people inside the rubble.
Yeah.
And these two individuals that are in this case...
You got two full guys in there?
Well, not full. Bits and pieces. And we're not sure if they're guys or gals. We're not sure of the sex of these individuals. We will find out eventually because they now have a very... They've been allowed into...
They haven't matriculated.
But they are at Harvard University.
Yes.
Presently, or at least select samples of them, particularly their Denton, is at the Harvard Medical School DNA lab. And they are being tested because we want to know everything about them that we can find out.
So now, what is it exactly we are going to find out about our guys?
Well,
our people.
Well, number one, one of the first things we'll know, and they told us this, of course, they give us a laundry list of, here's what we can tell you if all the analysis goes as expected, here's what we could tell you. Well, we'll be able to know if they're male or female. Now, they will probably give an estimation on the age. It's possible.
Yeah.
But we already pretty much know that because we have the upper jaws in each case, no lower jaw. This, remember, these are bits and pieces of individuals that were literally individuals that were literally blown apart in a very destructive, explosive event. And so they're in bits and pieces. And so we never found the, in fact, one of them just exists of the upper dentition and part of the right, I think it's the right orbit for the eye socket, and that's it. No cranium. The other one has a full cranium. The eye sockets are kind of compressed, smashed, and upper dentition. We don't have any lower jaw. We don't have anything bigger than about that. Maybe, you know, as big as one or two fingers. Maybe a piece of a rib, maybe a piece of a scapula or a hip, something like that.
And could actually be part of somebody else's skeleton.
Exactly. We don't know if these other pieces are, you know, like a finger, piece of a finger, a digit. Who does that belong to? We don't know if it belongs to them or somebody else. But one of the other things we're going to find out is, what is their ethnic connection?
Yeah.
Where have they come from? Do they carry just local DNA, Canaanite DNA? Do they have any Egyptian DNA floating around in there? Do they have any Aegean DNA in their mix? What about the Europeans? The European mix, any Indo-European DNA hanging out in their genetics.
Yeah.
So these are the things we want to know.
Now, this is what we want to know about the guys, but why does Harvard want to do this?
Well, because they maintain a very large database of ancient DNA from all over this region. And, of course, our guys will become part of that.
In fact, they're so interested in this. They've got grants to fund all of this, so we're not even having to pay for this research. They get to keep the data too, but we get the information we want to know. It's really great. And of course, the best part of the body to get this is, well, one of the two best parts are the teeth.
The teeth. Now, there's a little petrous bone up by the ear, and they could that's the ideal one. But we don't have that one. We might. Somewhere, maybe someday, as we expand the excavation, but right now we don't. So the second best to that is the dentin, that material inside the teeth. Now also they can do an isotopic analysis and possibly tell us where these individuals had been during their lifetime.
Yeah. So not just their DNA, what's their family line, but actually where they had physically lived for a period of time.
Yeah, have they actually, did they go to Egypt?
Yeah.
Did they go to Anatolia, Asia Minor? Where did they go in their lifetime? Maybe they went nowhere. Maybe they're just hanging out at the palace. And by the way, they're found on the ring road
outside the palace.
Between the upper city defensive wall and the palace exterior wall. So maybe they were in a nice, taking a nice stroll in that area, or maybe as guards, they were guards, lookouts, and sudden calamity came upon the city and upon them, and the rest is in the box.
So we've actually nicknamed our two guys, our two individuals in here, and what is it we call them?
Well, I mean, you know, when you have two guys, you think Bert and Ernie, right? I mean, you know, we all grew up on Sesame Street and all that. So we think Bert and Ernie. But they might be Berta and Ernestina. We don't know that. But we will eventually.
We will find out. Yeah. So I guess we could close this episode by telling everybody that Bert and Ernie went to Harvard.
They're at Harvard.
Not exactly the way we'd planned, but they're there, and we're happy for them.
They're not studying. They're being studied.
They're being studied. So that's the latest, and this is just recently happened, and we'll be keeping you posted about what Bert and Ernie, or Roberta and Ernestina, have got to tell us. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Troweling Down.